Economic recovery is gaining steam.
And it's being fueled by consumers.
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From American Public Media, hello, I'm Steve Chiotakis in Los Angeles.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson back in New York today. It's the midday update from Marketplace.org. It is Friday, January 28th. Happy Friday. Steve, I know you always like to say happy Friday, but today I will say happy
Friday. I yield to you, Jeremy.
Okay. Coming up, Egypt wants a communications breakdown as anti-government protests heat up. Tim Geithner speaks at Davos. And J.D. Salinger wrote about Holden and Phoebe and Stradlatter and his favorite fast food burger.
But first, the nation's economy grew by 3.2%. In the last 3 months of 2010, for the year, that growth was just under 3%, according to a Commerce Department report out today. Jill Schlesinger is editor-at-large at CBS Money Watch, as she is every Friday. She's with us from New York. Good morning, Jill.
Good morning.
Now, this is growth, right? 3.2% for the last quarter. How does this stack against other years?
Well, you know, you look at the post-war average, and that's been about 3.3%, and it sure is better than the negative rates we saw 2 years ago. But, you know, interesting, it's also stronger than the total growth rate for 2006, and that's when the housing boom was really chugging along. So pretty good performance here.
We thought the economy was really was going along at a nice clip in 06, right?
Absolutely.
You looked a little deeper at these numbers, though, right? So what morsels do we take from this figure?
Yeah, I thought this was kind of interesting. We actually did this on our own. Government growth was actually down on both the federal and local levels. That means the private sector did the heavy lifting last quarter, and consumption was up better than expected, up 4.4%. It was a really good quarter for car sales. And so on that level, I think the numbers are actually a little bit better than the big, broad headline you'll see tomorrow morning in the newspapers.
So people were buying a lot of stuff last year. All right. So 3.2% for the quarter, 2.9%, I believe, for the year, positive growth. My question is, where are the jobs, Jill?
You and the rest of America wants to know that. I mean, it's good growth. It's just not enough to spur a massive increase in hiring. You know, remember, why do companies hire when there is consistent demand for their goods and services? And so far, this recovery has been really spotty. We'll have one good quarter, it's followed by a weak quarter. That throws businesses off, and they really don't know how to plan for the future. So we need to see a bunch of quarters in a row where things are strong.
Look into your crystal ball. Do we see some job growth this year?
Definitely this year. I don't know if it's strong enough to make people happy.
Jill Schlesinger from CBS Money Watch in New York. Jill, thanks.
Great to be with you.
More on the nation's gross domestic product. Chris Lowe is chief economist at FTN Financial, and he joins us now. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning.
So what do you make of this GDP figure, 3.2% growth?
Well, 3.2% is solid. It was anchored by a 4% rise in consumption, which is really good. But I tell you, one of the most exciting things about the GDP report for me was a fairly substantial drawdown in inventories. The reason economists like to see that is it implies stronger growth going forward. I think we're going to see some upward revisions to expectations, too.
All right. Well, Chris, some economists have said that if we can grow fast enough, if this economy can grow fast enough, we might be able to grow ourselves out of some of the debt we have as a nation. Listen to what Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner said earlier today in Davos, Switzerland.
I would say the political will is not fully manifest yet at the moment, but it's coming. There's no alternative to it. There's no way to avoid it. We can't grow our way out of it.
We can't grow our way out of it. Chris, what do you think of that?
Wow. We have to grow our way out of it. And I think in a way we are. But I think what he meant to say was the government can't necessarily provide that growth. So it's a good thing we're starting to see the private sector kick in, because it is time to start taking the deficit seriously. Japan's debt was just downgraded by S&P, and Moody's used that to warn about the U.S.
Chris Lowe, chief economist with FTN Financial, thanks so much for your time.
You're welcome. Thank you.
In Egypt today, more anti-government protests as rioters in the streets clash with police. In an effort to hold back the violence there, the country today shut down the internet and cell phone communication. David Butter is Middle East head of the Economist magazine's intelligence unit. He's with us from London. Good morning.
Hi, good morning.
How does a government just shut down the internet? They have an on-off switch?
The whole telecommunications sector in Egypt still has a fair amount of state control over it. And so I think that it probably is not that difficult for people in the intelligence services or the police to hand out instructions to the relevant engineers at the various choke points. So I think ultimately it is people turning off a few switches.
How's this going to affect the connections, Egypt's connections to the global economy and to the American economy as well?
Clearly, because today is Friday, which is a holiday in Muslim countries, and it's not a business day. Tomorrow is also a day off for the financial sector. The government appears to be calculating that the fallout from this in terms of financial flows and reputation will be limited, but it does set quite a worrying precedent. And I think it would only add to the flight of capital that we've seen over the last couple of days when the markets eventually open up.
David Butter from the Economist Intelligence Unit in London. David, thank you.
Thank you.
Let's talk more now about the shutdown of internet and cell phone service in Egypt. Caroline McCarthy is a tech reporter for CNET.com, and she joins me now here in our New York studio. Good morning.
Good morning.
So what do you make of what's going on over in Egypt?
I think what's really interesting is that with all of these crackdowns on technology and new media communications, it shows that the top priority of a threatened autocratic government now is not necessarily to crack down on the mass media, on television and newspapers, but to crack down on this new kind of social media and digital communications where millions of people can connect with each other.
To crack down on mobile phones and on internet, how is it possible technically to shut down the internet in a country?
Well, it absolutely is technically possible. There actually has been some talk on Capitol Hill over whether the U.S. should have a quote-unquote kill switch in the event of, for example, a cyber terrorist attack. In other countries, that kill switch exists, and it's very possible for internet access to be shut off.
What about mobile phones? I mean, you can't just turn off all mobile phones. You have to go to the companies, right?
Right. Mobile phones are a little more complicated. One carrier, Vodafone, has said that the Egyptian government has asked them to turn off service.
Right.
And legally, the government does have a right to do that because Vodafone and other carriers agreed to that when they entered the Egyptian market.
And Vodafone and other carriers are not worried about how that might look in other markets?
Well, the truth is that telecommunications and access companies make these agreements all the time. Egypt has 80 million residents. It's a big market for a cell phone company. And they agree to these terms when they go into these countries. For example, at first, Apple was going to have to manufacture iPhones without the GPS chip to sell them in Egypt. Ultimately, that didn't work out that way, and Apple was able to sell them with the chip. But they do make these agreements.
Caroline McCarthy, tech reporter with CNET.com. Thanks so much for your time this morning.
Thank you.
Ford today, Jeremy, announced it made more money last year than any year since 1999, more than 10 years. Yeah. So we know Detroit is doing better these days. But what's surprising about the news from Ford is where the company's profits are focused. Marketplace's Elisa Roth covers the auto industry for us.
The main reason Ford is doing so well is pretty obvious. People are buying cars again. Almost 20% more Fords last year, almost 30% more of the F-Series pickup trucks. Some companies, like GM, are making a killing in emerging markets. Brazil, India, China. Ford is still trying to figure out what to do there. But it doesn't seem to matter much. Bob Schultz follows cars at Standard & Poor's. He says for Ford, it's all about the market at home.
The overall performance is really a North American story as they have gotten the cost down and have gained share in the sales and the market have recovered.
Like other car makers, Ford has gotten costs down by using fewer workers and earning more on every vehicle it sells. Schultz says he thinks Ford sales will keep going up in both 2011 and 2012, but that the growth won't be quite as dramatic as it was last year. I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Friday, January 28th. I'm Steve Chiotakis in Los Angeles. You can follow me on Twitter at Radio Chio.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York on Twitter, too, at Jeremy Hobson. Don't forget, you can get the latest look at the markets anytime by checking out the numbers section at marketplace.org.
Now to the global perspective, what's happening in business and economics at the intersection of the U.S. and the rest of the world. At the World Economic Forum going on in Davos, Switzerland, many bankers and world leaders say the recovery is picking up.
But there's worry over budget deficits and debt. U.S. Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner, who spoke at the forum today, says the American economy is expanding, but the nation's debt is like a dark cloud on the horizon, and that it'll require political will to cut spending.
I would say the political will is not fully manifest yet at the moment, but it's coming. There's no alternative to it. There's no way to avoid it. We can't grow our way out of it.
More from Davos and deficits and Marketplace's Europe correspondent Stephen Beard. He's with us from London with more. Good morning, Stephen.
Hello, Jeremy.
So why is Secretary Geithner talking about the U.S. debt right now in Davos?
Well, austerity seems to have taken center stage. The Brits, of course, have already embarked on deep spending cuts. And the British Prime Minister, David Cameron, in Davos this morning, was justifying that policy, which is controversial. George Soros, the fund manager, earlier this week in Davos said that the UK risked tipping its economy back into recession with these cuts.
Right. That's an argument we've heard from a few economists over here as well. If that's the case, though, that budget cutting could tip the global recovery backwards, why are countries doing it right now?
It's all to do with credit rating. I mean, when you get a powerful economy like Japan with its credit rating downgraded because of its debts, it could certainly happen to the likes of the UK. And a downgrade would not only push up the cost of government borrowing for Britain, it would drive down the pound, making it more expensive to buy goods from abroad and increasing inflation. Now, the US, of course, is in a very different position. It has a reserve currency. Foreigners are still rushing to put money into the dollar, but it certainly could suffer a downgrade.
Well, we'll see what happens. Marketplace's Stephen Beard in London. Thanks, Stephen.
Okay, Jeremy.
In Australia, the government there announced a proposal for a temporary tax to help pay for damage from historic flooding. The country's reeling from heavy rains and high waters in Queensland state. That has economic repercussions all around the world because of agriculture and coal that's produced there. But the cleanup could also help the Australian economy. Gemma Daly is a reporter for Bloomberg News, and she's with us from the country's capital, Canberra. Good morning.
Good morning.
Give us an idea of what the recovery is going to look like over there.
The recovery is going to be enormous. People have told me that the road rebuilding will be a project of which we've never seen before. Schools have been washed away. Culverts have been destroyed. Airports have been washed away. This is the biggest reconstruction Australia has ever been through.
What kind of money are we talking about here?
The federal government said today that their share of the reconstruction would be $5.6 billion, but also that's very preliminary figures. The water hasn't actually gone down in a lot of areas yet, and there are rising waters in other states like Victoria. Some economists have forecast it will be more to the tune of $20 billion.
There are a lot of people who are suffering, obviously, in Australia because of this flooding. You say in your piece, though, there's a stimulus working here. How will this recovery affect the economy there? That's going to put a lot of people to work, right?
That's right. And the government today also said they were going to make it easier for skilled migrants from overseas to come and work here. The unemployment rate is very low and there are labour shortages across Australia because of a mining boom to feed China's appetite for resources. There are estimates from economists of a 1% addition to GDP, yet there are lots of ramifications, i.e. fruit and vegetable prices will go up because of the loss of crops. In Queensland, many people have to rebuild or repair their house. They'll need tiles, they'll need bricks, they'll need curtains, they'll need couches and televisions. So there will be some increase in the demand side for consumers in Queensland.
Gemma Daly, reporter for Bloomberg, reporting from Australia for us. Gemma, thank you so much.
No problem. Thanks, Steve.
And we have a slideshow of the damage in Australia at our website, marketplace.org.
In Norway today, countries that border the Arctic Circle are wrapping up a development conference. They say melting ice means more ships can use Arctic waters. But as Eve Troe reports from the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, that's not as easy as it sounds.
Sending ships across the Arctic is a long-standing dream in the shipping industry. Joe Keefe with the Maritime Reporter says four commercial vessels made it across the Arctic last year, more than ever before.
Saved their companies thousands of miles of transit times compared to going around the Horn and through one of the canals.
But he says those were experimental voyages, and transarctic shipping should stay that way for now, because systems aren't ready.
training people to do things like navigate through ice, there's very few people that actually know how to do that.
Keefe says more companies are training for polar conditions. David Balton with the U.S. State Department says major shipping across the Arctic is many years away, because even with historic amounts of ice melting, the Arctic is still only passable in the short summer.
It costs a great deal of money to retrofit boats to sail all the way through icy waters only for a few weeks a year.
He says companies don't have polar fleets that could, say, take wheat from the U.S. to China yet. But as more ice melts each year, that is where things are headed. I'm Eve Troe for Marketplace.
A tennis match tomorrow at the Australian Open will be a first. It'll be the first time, Steve, that a player from China competes in a Grand Slam singles final.
I remember
you've heard about
this,
28-year-old Li Na. She's become a big sensation over in China. Well, she was asked what motivated her to get through one of the sets that got her to tomorrow's match. Her answer? Prize money. Prize money. It's all about the money.
Makes sense.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Friday, January 28th. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And in Los Angeles, I'm Steve Chiatakis. Check out our website for the latest numbers, updated podcasts, and some fun and exciting games, too. Like, Jeremy, I'm sure you've played this a few times, the Future Jobs-O-Matic.
Oh, the Future Jobs-O-Matic. Budget Hero. You can go and play that, too.
There's Budget Hero. The jobs game is where you can explore new jobs. Have you been to this? Have you checked this out?
This is really cool. Yeah.
You can explore new jobs, whether the jobs are in demand in the marketplace, and how much those jobs pay. And then, of course, Budget Hero lets you play finance chief of whatever country or
and it's
town.
Very popular. Both of those games, very popular.
Really. All at our website, marketplace.org.
Well, as of today, NBC Universal becomes a division of the nation's largest cable company, Comcast. The long-awaited deal will force a lot of changes, including the removal of the famous peacock from the NBC Universal logo. And some watchdog groups are concerned that the takeover could compromise NBC's news operations. Marketplace's Janet Babin reports.
Comcast runs E! Entertainment, Style, and the Versus Sports Channel. With the merger, it'll also oversee MSNBC, The Today Show, Meet the Press, and 10 TV stations NBC owns around the country. Consumer groups point out Comcast has little experience running news networks. Editor Matthew Bellany at The Hollywood Reporter says the concern is that money spent on news and public affairs will now be diverted elsewhere.
Maybe they're going to go for sports, try to put big sporting events on their Versus network so they can try to build that up and create a competitor to ESPN.
In a statement, NBC Universal said its stations have committed to expanding news programming, and it said Comcast does not and will not run the news division. NBC News will. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
Christie's Auction House is reporting sales of more than $5 billion for 2010. That marks the best year in the company's 245-year history. Now, that's in part thanks to strong sales of Impressionist and modern art. That's good for Christie's. But for the people who make their living making visual art, here's a story of a serious workplace hazard. Many art supplies contain lead and other dangerous compounds, as reporter Tanya Ott explains.
Larry Stevens shakes a can of spray paint, then starts applying it to a canvas. Stevens paints professionally under the name Sinister. He sells his work in galleries in Michigan and California. Most of the time, he paints outside. But in winter, he's indoors, wearing a respirator or a dust mask. It's not enough.
You know, within a couple of hours, you know, I'll start getting dizzy, and, you know, you'll end up coughing up paint the next morning. And if you'll go to blow your nose, and it'll be green and red and yellow and whatever colors you were using that day.
Experts say there are no large-scale health studies of people who use art supplies. But Dr. Stephen Marcus, who is New Jersey's poison control chief, says lead, arsenic, and cadmium are found in some paint pigments. And some glues and cements contain chemicals that can cause neurological damage. In one condition, called wrist drop, sufferers actually lose strength in their hands.
For an artist, that's their bread and butter. They lose strength in their hands and they can't be an artist.
Most art supplies come with warnings, like using proper ventilation. But Marcus says they don't really define proper.
And then consider that some artists live and work in the same building.
You know, you can't wear the respirator 24/7.
And I'll take a newspaper. And...
Artist Larry Stevens knows this too well. About a year ago, doctors found a spot on his lung. He doesn't know if it's cancer because he hasn't had any follow-up tests. He says he can't afford health insurance.
It's just not in the cards right now. Now, I'm not going to go in debt for a spot on my lung that could be something or might not be.
In the meantime, the U.S. Senate is considering legislation to update the Toxic Substances Control Act. That might help professional artists and hobbyists get a better picture on the true dangers they could face. I'm Tanya Ott for Marketplace.
And finally, Jeremy, for the one-year anniversary of author J.D. Salinger's death, an Englishman who knew Salinger for decades released more than 50 letters between the two men. In those letters, the man who wrote The Catcher in the Rye apparently wrote about his love of gardening and his love of seeing Niagara Falls and the tourists there and his preference for fast food burgers. This is one of the things that he talked about in these letters. Apparently Salinger, and I did not know this, preferred Burger King over the others.
Whopper. He was a Whopper guy.
He was a Whopper guy, not so much Big Mac or what do they have at Wendy's? The single, the double, all that? The Baconator. Didn't like any of those, right? Holden Caulfield, I'm told, Jeremy, thought all fast food, though, was phony.
Not Salinger.
Not Salinger. He loved the Whopper. I'm Steve Chiatakis in Los Angeles.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York. This is the Marketplace Midday Update. Have a great weekend.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.